to Concha Pulse. This is Julie Valamont. This week we talk with fiddler Audrey Knuth. You know Audrey is performing if the room is buzzing with energy. Her fiddling has been featured in bands including the Free Raisins, the Gaslight Tinkers, Audacious with Larry Unger, and Wake Up Robin. And she has electrified dance and concert halls across the U.S. and Europe. Hailing from Honolulu and now living in California, she cut her folk teeth in the Boston area, attending Berklee College of Music, where she studied sound engineering, and then she spent years exploring the thriving New England folk scene. Audrey's fiddle playing is rhythmically lively and spontaneous and irresistibly danceable. She's also been on staff at various camps, including CDSS English Week at Pinewoods, Ashokan Northern Week, BACDS American Week, and Halsey Manor in England. Audrey and I had a lot of fun reminiscing about our various Contra adventures together and our shared roots in the Boston scene. And we talked about her transition from classical violin to fiddle, her priorities as a dance fiddler, her violin inspirations, and a lot more. Obviously, since she's on the other side of the country, we talked over Zoom and recorded our conversation. Hope you enjoy. Audrey Knuth, welcome to Contra Pulse.
Hi, Julie. It's so nice to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. And by here, I mean there, because you are in California and I am in Vermont.
True story.
Yeah, this is our first ever, Zoom phone call over the internet podcast episode.
Well, I feel very honored to be the first one.
Yes. We'll see what goes wrong. It's going to be great.
I apologize in advance to all of you listeners.
And I've been giving people a weather report because we've been doing all these interviews on my porch, but it's actually raining right now. And so we'll see if the rain gets hard enough, if you can hear little drips of rain in my background audio or not.
Oh, wow. Well, I can give you the weather report here in San Diego. The high was 92 with a humidity of 50%. And it was very nice today.
I want to be there.
It's kind of perfect.
Also, you guys have really good sushi.
Oh my gosh. I don't want to like go off on a sushi like tangent, but we have discovered, delivery and takeout sushi from the places have opened up downtown, and it's incredible.
It's amazing. I mean, that is one of the fun things about being a dance musician when you travel a lot, is like going to different places and seeking out new restaurants. And, you know, we always got our sushi fix on the West Coast.
Oh my gosh. I also discovered that I have an addiction to breakfast burritos, and I never had a real breakfast burrito until I was here in San Diego. And so...
I really want to ask you what you think makes a good breakfast burrito, but it's going to full-on turn this into a cooking podcast.
It's a whole separate food category. I'll just leave it as like that.
What is in it? Now I need to know.
Secret San Diego sauce? I have no idea. That we're 10 miles away from the Mexican border.
Yeah.
Magic. I think that's the secret.
That's the secret. Well, let's talk about not burritos.
Or sushi.
But let's talk about something we know and love, concha dancing. And of course, you and I have known each other for years. And back when you moved to Boston, I think is when I met you, years and years ago, when you were a Berkeley student. But wait, you were at Berkeley, right?
I was, yes.
Okay, great. I don't want to get that wrong. But let's go even farther back into time.
The Wayback Machine. Yeah.
Let's go back to your early days as a fiddler. And how did you get started playing for concha dances?
Oh, gosh. That's a good question. I was very lucky in that I got to grow up in Hawaii, of all places. And one might ask, how did you get into concha dance in Hawaii? But I, in middle school, discovered Irish dancing. There was a kind of a local school from a military family who started it. And I was playing for the dances on St. Patrick's Day at the Halikoa Hotel on St. Patrick's Day, like you do in Hawaii. And I had a couple musicians approach me, and they were like, have you heard of concha dance before? And I had no idea. And little did I know that that conversation would kind of like change my entire life. And got into playing and dancing at the local Honolulu Concha Dance first and third Saturdays at the Atherton on the UH campus. And kind of fell in love with it there. And then when I moved to Boston to go to school, rumors had it that there were concha dancers that might be my age, maybe. I got taken to the Scout House, the Thursday Scout House, and my first concha dance experience in Boston was with Nils Fredlin calling and Crowfoot playing. And there was no looking back after that.
No.
It was the beginning of the end for me.
That's magic.
Yeah.
You know, I was at a dance with Crowfoot when I decided to become a concha musician also. They have lured many of us into this world.
I had no idea. Gosh. Wow.
I wonder if we were at the same dance.
Quite possibly. This is going on now 10 years ago. 12 years ago. I moved to Boston in 2008.
Yeah.
And... yeah.
So it was a few years earlier for me. So not the same Crowfoot dance, but the same magic.
I bet they were playing the same tune.
They probably were. Wow. And so when you got inspired by this in Boston, how did you like find your way into the concha scene in Boston?
Well, you're kind of partially to blame. I hate to say it, or happy to say it. And that... that as a college student, you kind of get sucked into college world. My goals in life were to become a sound engineer, actually, and had no, you know, fiddling was going to be a side fun thing. But someone told me about the MIT contra dance and that it was sit-in friendly. And I don't know how I, like, convinced myself to go without knowing anybody. That's very unlike me. But I guess I, like, went, and I remember playing with you and Peter on accordion. And I remember, like, we had, like, an awesome time playing, and you guys were so nice to me. And I remember asking, I was like, oh, what do you do for a living, Julie? And you're like, well, I work part-time at a museum, but I mostly, like, play for contra dances. And I was like, what? What? You can make a living playing for contra dances? There are dance weekends. Like, people pay money and dance all weekend. I had no concept of that whatsoever. And then Jeff Kaufman found me at the MIT dance, and it was all downhill from there. Yeah, I had no plan. This was not part of my life plan in any shape or form. And here I am now talking to you on a contra dance podcast.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's so funny, those little serendipitous things. I actually discovered the MIT contra dance much like you did, where someone told me that there was one and it was sit-in friendly. And Peter Buchak, I was a friend of his, and Dan Solomon, like, we met going to the Thursday dance, which was first at the VFW and then Spring Step and then Scout House, like the same dance as you. Mm-hmm. And then I just found that Peter was running the MIT contra, and he made it so friendly. He wasn't running it, but some nights he would lead the band. Other nights, Victor Troll, I remember, would play piano for the band.
Yeah.
And I didn't know any tunes yet. Audrey, I didn't know how to play contra piano yet. I sat in on Penny Whistle, and Peter was still friends with me afterwards.
You're blowing my mind.
I am a terrible Penny Whistle player.
You'll have to play for me sometime.
Yeah, but I wanted an instrument where I could learn the tunes.
Yeah.
And so I played Penny Whistle, then I played melodica. And then finally I got an accordion. So talk Phew. About downhill.
I think it was a massive upgrade.
And I remember meeting you there. That was when Peter and I had the banana band,
La Banane
Enchante. And those were really fun days. That dance was so welcoming to new people and so friendly.
Yeah,
and very, I mean, had very it, supportive.
Had it not been, I would have showed up once and that would be the end of it. Mm-hmm. And again, feeling extremely welcome and being invited back to play. At that time, like, I grew up playing classical music, and even when I was playing in the contra dance band in Hawaii, I refused to take the sheet music away. I was very much paper trained. And like, I remember panicking, like, I don't know this tune and it's not in a tune book. Ah. And then being like, oh, maybe I could try to, like, play this without looking at music. What a concept. Mm-hmm. And that was a really big struggle for me, actually. And it really took actually a few years of playing contra dances every weekend, or just these sit-in friendly things of being forced to not look at the music, was also like a big game changer for me.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular tricks that you used to learn how to play tunes, or was it just time and repetition?
I wish there was like a magic button where I was like, I'm not going to read sheet music anymore. The secret was the Free Raisins lugging our sound gear to every contra dance in a, you know, 100-mile radius every single weekend, playing the Medway dance, the Concord, yeah, New Hampshire dance, Northampton, Worcester, all of these smaller dances. And we had a repertoire of, I don't know, 20 tunes or something like that. And then, like, playing them over and over again, being like, oh, wait, maybe I don't need the music. I think Jeff and Amy also kind of encouraged me, like, you know, you've been playing this tune for a while, you know, you don't actually need the music. And that, like, if you play a wrong note, they're not going to notice. Or, like, we trust you to figure out what to do if you miss one note.
Yeah.
And same thing to go with, like, my particular fiddle style. Like, I listened to a recording. We, like, recorded our very first dance, which was at Spring Step. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, I won't say it's laughable right now, but I sounded nothing like I sound right now. And I didn't do anything specifically to like work on my fiddle style. Like, I want to sound like X, Y, and Z. It was really just playing constantly every weekend in front of an audience and wanting to be different or like wanting to do my best. And so it was just these little like baby steps of increments of what happens if I like don't play the melody at all one time through? Like, what happens if I don't play? Ah, just like these very baby steps that kind of led me to that. But definitely no magic button.
Yeah, I mean, time and repetition are a good way to learn.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say that I forgot to mention is that like, I have so much to thank Amy and Jeff for, but after we recorded every single Contra Dance that we did, and because we were doing a lot of driving, we had the opportunity to listen to ourselves on the drive home late at night. And so like going down to the Cape and it's an hour and a half drive home, we would listen to ourselves back to keep us awake. And it was really enlightening. One, not listening, like, I wouldn't have listened to us back by myself. It would have been too discouraging, I think, of just when you're playing or when you're listening back to yourself, all you can hear are your mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And how, like, oh my gosh, what was I thinking? But having supportive bandmates like Jeff and Amy, we would listen back together and they would like give positive feedback. Like, oh, I really liked that thing that you did. And that was something that I didn't even notice that I was playing. And by hearing them say that, I was like, oh, maybe I'll try that again. And of course, we heard what we were doing wrong as well. But it was all within like positivity and like, ooh, that's something that didn't quite work, but I see what you were trying to do. Next time, let's try it a different way. Or let's try to work on that idea. And just having, again, those positive bandmates was a really big, big deal and kind of like boosted my confidence in playing. And I think got better because I was hearing they were telling me things that they liked in my playing.
Yeah. And so, for context, this is Jeff Kaufman and Amy Engelsberg.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
And you're in your band, The Free Raisins. And we'll link to that in the podcast notes.
Yeah.
And I remember when the three of you were starting a band because I knew Amy as like another kind of new piano player. And I knew Jeff just because everybody knows Jeff.
Everybody
somehow
knows Jeff.
And so somebody told me, Jeff and Amy and Audrey are starting a band. And I was like, yeah, cool.
I think people knew we were starting a band before I knew that we were starting a band, by the way.
Probably Jeff wrote about it on his blog or something. That's probably how you found out.
Yeah, like he was like, hey, Amy, Audrey, do you want to get together and just like play a couple of tunes? And I was like, sure, that sounds great. And by the end of the rehearsal, we had like Jeff had already emailed and got a gig booked for like the next month.
I love Jeff. He knows how to make things happen.
Seriously, I have so much to thank him for. Like, I would have never done that. I would have, like, we would have played like once and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, those little people with initiative who come up in our lives and kind of push things. You and I actually had very similar starts. Like, so much is in common. Like, I started playing at the MIT Contra Dance also.
Yeah.
And my first contra band formed there. And then when Nor'easter formed, Max and Cedar and I also all met at the MIT Contra Dance.
Wow.
And I still couldn't play tunes from ear when that band started. I had an Excel spreadsheet with all the chords written in it for all the tunes that we played. And each cell of the spreadsheet was like a measure or something, kind of like the way you write out chord charts.
Mm-hmm.
It's mortifying now to think that I ever did that, but you have to start somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
And then I put myself on like I put on a bunch of recordings of different bands and I just listened to them constantly back when iPods were a thing and I put them all on my iPod.
Oh, the sound of the wheel. So satisfying.
Yeah. That little thing, that sound. And I would like at the gym, on the bus, washing the dishes, at my office, I just listened to tunes in the background of my head until my subconscious started hearing the different patterns.
Wow.
And then eventually I could then start to hear the differences between like different genres and styles of tunes like French Canadian versus old time or whatever, just as you probably did, and like incorporate all that somehow subconsciously into your fiddle playing.
Yeah, wow. I think I was starting, having played for the local contra dance in Hawaii, I had some concept of it. But being a melody player, you know, that was something that I already had kind of ingrained. I can't imagine, having no concept of tunes. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that, Julie. You're blowing my mind.
Wow. I didn't know the difference between a jig and a reel at first. They had to teach me. You know, I had been a... This interview is not about me, but I think it's fun to draw parallels between my experience and yours, just because maybe it'll help inspire new musicians who could start just as badly as both of us. But I had been a classical musician and I was a church organist for many years. And starting at age 14, I played organ for my local church.
Wow.
And so for me, conscience is like, oh, look, there's a bunch of people and I have to entertain them and I have to multitask. I have those skills, but I didn't know any of the music. So it's been really fun to learn. But this is not about me. This is about you.
The other thing that I want to mention, that I think helped was that because I didn't really understand the conscience world and what it looked like, I had zero pressure on myself. I don't know if this is inspiring at all, but I had no goals. It wasn't we're going to be the best contra dance band in the world and we're going to take over the planet and make money. It was something that we had a lot of fun doing, and it's fun learning and becoming better, but we didn't put pressure on ourselves to do dance weekends to do that. And I think that organic process really helped, because I think if I did put that pressure, or if I knew how good you had to be in order to be a real contra dance weekend band, I think I would have stopped. I think I would have gotten overwhelmed.
Yeah. I think at its best, contra dance music is a labor of love.
Yeah.
You know, and you do it because you love it, and you can get good at it through practice and repetition, but you should also enjoy that process, you know, enjoy the process of listening back to recordings and tightening arrangements and learning how to play tightly together. I love that process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting. I feel that process becomes magnified when you're recording or you're making CDs, is that that time, playing contra dances for, weekend and week out, definitely you get better. But then when you're all of a sudden I have to make a CD, you take that and you condense it, that time to condense when you start really getting creative with arrangements and stuff. So a lot of the arrangements that the Free Raisins do, and Wake Up Robin, what we do live, really a lot of it happened when we were sitting down in the studio or thinking about what we were going to do to record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just talking with somebody else about that. It's a lot of arrangements at contra dances just sort of happen on the fly, if they're arrangements at all. You make up something and maybe the band follows you in it. And so then you can condense some of those ideas for a CD. That's one possibility. Mm-hmm. But another one is that the stuff you think of in the studio, then you can start trying out on the dance floor.
And sometimes it doesn't work on the dance floor. Yeah. There's no guarantee, by the way.
Yeah. Nor should it have to. They're kind of different animals.
Yeah.
You know, for most bands, contra bands, their album is a slightly different feel.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a few live recordings, but not a lot.
Yeah. I have to say, the Buddy System record is probably my most listened to contra dance CD. I absolutely love it. It helped that I had it in my car. It was the only CD I had in my car for a while. And now, Emily Rush has been kind of taking over, or has done this Zoom workouts, this contra dance Zoom workouts. This is not a plug for it, I promise, but it's really fun. And we will exercise to the Buddy System.
That's great. That makes me happy. You should check out the Zoom workouts. I mean, we're in COVID times right now and people have to find camaraderie and stay healthy. So they're really fun. Emily puts video to it and contra dance soundtracks and stay in shape. We'll put that link in the podcast notes as well. Well, with the Free Raisins, you eventually started playing dance weekends all over the country, and then you went to record your first album. Well, I keep saying first, it's your album.
Yeah.
And Andrew Van Nostrand was your producer, which kind of started this organic process that eventually ended up forming Wake Up Robin.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I'd love to. The Free Raisins, our first dance weekend was Catapult. That was the first one that I think we got booked for. And if folks don't know what Catapult was, it was basically six up-and-coming bands and six callers, and you played for the weekend. Oh, yeah, Julie, you guys did it as well with Enchanté. And that was a lot of fun and also very nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Actually, it's unlike any Contra Dance weekend where, I don't know, and it was really awesome that we got that opportunity, that dance weekend existed and allowed bands that otherwise wouldn't have gotten known. And so that really helped. And we toured in Syracuse, and I think that's where Andrew first heard the Free Raisins and booked us for Great Bear Groove. So those two dance weekends that year, I can't remember which year it was, maybe 2013, was kind of a big year for us in that we started playing dance weekends. And yeah, and we met Andrew through there and Noah, of course, and Andrew produced the Free Raisins record. And there was one summer when Lily, his first daughter, was born, and Amy and I still wanted to go on a tour. And so we asked Andrew to come along with us. And that was kind of the beginning of Wake Up Robin, originally called AAA, but turns out that's very confusing and a very dumb name. So...
and I did like my joke there where like once you add Noah to it, then it's N-A-A-A, and I was like, nah. I know, so funny. Not funny, sorry everybody.
And coming up with a band name, by the way, is like more stressful than anything. I'm just putting it out there. That is more stressful than picking tunes or whatever. Just like, So I'm quite happy with Wake Up Robin. Andrew and, you know, obviously loves birds. And so it had to be a bird name. And Sarah, his wife, her favorite flower is the Wake Robin, the Trillium flower. And so Wake Robin happens, unfortunately, to be a name of lots of funeral homes. So we didn't want to be Wake Robin. So we settled for Wake Up Robin.
That's a fun story. Also, Nightingale was already taken.
Yeah, exactly. Shucks.
And so that band is you and Amy and Andrew and Noah together.
Yeah. And yeah. I also, for the record, I do not want to leave out the Gaslight Tinkers, because that is like, I have never had so much fun on stage and rocking out so hard than playing with the Gaslight Tinkers, and feel so honored that I got to play fiddle with those guys for a few years, and really miss them and miss hanging out with them.
They seem like a really fun group of people.
So much fun. I'm sure you'll put the link up to them, but the band... when I was in it was with Garrett Sawyer on bass, who is the sound engineer for Northfire, where a lot of Contra Dance records have been recorded. Peter Siegel, who you've interviewed for this. And then Jopie, the drummer, who is just so much fun and rock solid and can play any drum beat you ask him to. So much fun.
That's a great combination of people. So you played for with Gaslight Tinkers for a while before you moved out to the West Coast.
Yeah.
Wow, fun times.
Yeah, and I can't forget Larry Unger either. Hi, Larry.
Oh, yeah.
Don't forget Larry.
Larry will also be on this podcast. You played with Larry, did a lot of traveling with him, went to England and some other cool things.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. It's really interesting, you know, now that we're at home and not traveling, it's been also kind of a time of reflection and kind of really thinking back on how lucky, both of us have been and all of the travels that we have done. And yeah, and, you know, I don't know if I will continue doing as much traveling as I did before, but I feel very, very lucky for the Contra Dance community for letting me kind of live this lifestyle for mm-hmm. so many years.
Me too, absolutely. Yeah. It's a wonderful world of people out there, and meeting so many people who are like-minded and like to have fun, and it's just been, and the travel and the sushi. Let's talk about sushi some more. Or like, you know, I think contra musicians, like, we kind of combine with each other in these little clumps, and some of them are like official bands, and some of them are unofficial bands, and some of them are just temporary clumps. But
I like being in a temporary clump with you, Julie.
Yeah, we've had some great temporary clumps. There was a summer at Ashokan when we led the English band. That was really fun. And then we were in France and England together because Buddy System was out there, and you traveled around with us. And we had that week in Brittany where we just put, remember we bought all the cheese in the market and put it in the glove compartment of our rental car?
What's that smell?
It smelled amazing.
Oh my gosh.
And then we would drive to the ocean or some beautiful city and put all the cheese on the dashboard and have a picnic in the car.
Oh my gosh. I was actually just looking at those pictures today. I taught in my tunes class on Monday. Rain of Love, but I use it as an excuse to kind of go through Breton music and kind of use that as a segue into talking about that music. And so I was looking through our pictures to send a picture in the kind of the newsletter. And I found the picture of you, me, and Noah in the car with all the cheeses. And I'm in the back chugging this huge bottle of cider.
hard cider.
Hard cider, by the way. And I was like, well, maybe I shouldn't send that picture out to hundreds of people, but here I am talking about it on a podcast.
Yeah.
But the picture just exemplifies how much fun we had and like so much food that we had. And just, it was just such a, it's such a beautiful part of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And getting to meet all the London folks and like you knowing the London folks and getting, like you were all friends with them. And so getting to meet them through you was really fun. Such a great trip.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, Rain of Love is a tune in the Breton style, I guess you'd say. I think it's a Keith Murphy tune.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just another example of all the different ways that contra dance music has been influenced by tunes from England and France and, you know, in addition to Scotland and Ireland and all these other places.
Absolutely.
And you travel and you get inspired by things that, you know, suit your whims, and then you bring them back and you think, hey, this might work for contra dance.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
And sometimes it doesn't. Absolutely. Thank you. man, there's so many things I could ask you about. I just want to talk about travel and cheese some more.
I know.
You can tell we've been pent up for so long. But I'd like to ask you about your fiddle style. And once you started playing for dances, do you know like how your fiddle has changed, how your fiddling has changed? Or have you had people whose styles you've emulated?
This is such a good question for right now, because the answer is I never I'm going to study X, Y, and Z. Like people used to ask me, oh, who's your favorite fiddle player? And mm-hmm. I would always say Lissa Schneckenberger, because her record with Bruce Rosen, the Phantom Power record, was one of the first contradance records I ever heard. And it's one of my favorites and still listen to it. But I sound nothing like her. like there's no and so I can't give that answer anymore because I don't sound like her. But I have never really stopped to kind of evaluate what exactly my fiddle style is. And I think contradance musicians and perhaps fiddle players especially kind of go through these identity crises where we're not one thing or the other. I can't say I'm a trad New England player. I don't like, I play for New England contra dances, but I don't play exclusively out of the New England repertoire book, right? I love old time and play Irish and I do my very best to emulate those styles when I'm playing those styles. But I'm not one thing or the other. And kind of being at home and doing so much more teaching than I have ever had in my entire life, I'm actually forced now for the very first time in my life to break down my fiddle style and like particular like bow patterns. And I'm finding these trends that I'm doing that come across that kind of cross over genres. And so there's a lot of actually like Quebecois bounce that I do in my bowing that I do in old time and Irish tunes, that there's just kind of bounce, you know, at the balance point, I'm making the gesture as if people can see me.
Maybe you'll have to describe the gesture to them.
Bounce, 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 bounce.
Audrey's flexing her wrist as if she's holding a bow.
Exactly.
She looks a little bit like a duckling. Is that the sound that Wake Up Robin makes?
Caw-caw is actually Wake Up Robin makes. Because, you know, robins go, caw-caw, caw-caw.
That's why it's funny.
But yeah, so kind of forcing myself to break down what I do with my bowing styles and like, am I okay with this? And kind of slowly accepting the fact that I will never be 100% an Irish musician. I will never 100% be an old time fiddle player. And I love playing those tunes and I will do what I can to emulate those styles. But like just coming to terms and being okay with, I'm a contradance fiddle player. My job is to play for dances. And if what I do makes people want to dance, then I am doing my job. And so it's been a really interesting and sometimes frustrating road, to be honest with you, of breaking down and being like, gosh, do I really do that bowing everywhere? Ugh, okay. maybe try starting on an up bow. I don't know. So I'm hoping, like, again, like now that I'm at home, that I'm, you know, kind of analyzing and perhaps like learn a bunch about my fiddle playing in particular. I'm not promising that I'll sound completely different when I come out of this, by the way, but
well, I'm understanding. You don't.
Yeah. But I'm understanding my playing a little bit more. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I feel like a lot of country musicians don't necessarily think about or articulate where their style comes from. Because there's not a formal way that you learn it. You just kind of do it through osmosis. In fact, I think it's the best way to learn. Like, if you want to learn a good contra groove, play along with people who have a good contra groove and you internalize it. And your own body will figure out what motions you need to make with your bow to make that groove happen. She's flailing her wrists around, everyone.
It works. It works. That's the secret to contra dance playing.
Wow, I never knew. All these years I've been doing it wrong.
Well, and I think also like going to music camps, like I can't help but think about Andrew and Noah, where they grew up going to a Shokan camp, where you, Northern Week in particular, where you are exposed to so many different genres, you know, Quebecois, Irish, old time, you know, whatever, a contra dance, whatever's there and whoever the teacher is, that you're going to learn a lot from that player. So I think Just, and for my sake, just like listening to the contra dance bands that are playing out there right now. And I think, yeah, just subconsciously listening to what makes that work. And I'm not purposely emulating them. But I don't know, whatever I do, I guess it works.
Well, it's kind of like what goes in comes out, right? It's like the fiddle version of you are what you eat, you know? Yeah. The people you jam with, the music you listen to, the people around you.
Yeah. And, you know, I've gotten this question asked, you know, or like, how did, like, the same question of like, how did you get your fiddle style, blah, blah, blah. And one of the biggest things that I have to say is like playing with people who are better than me and playing with as many different people as well has been a really big factor. And I think I noticed, you know, I really, you know, I honed in kind of my foundational fiddle playing with the Free Raisins. But I think once I started playing with other people, and hearing other influences as well, I think that also made a big difference in my playing. Because when you're playing with somebody, I mean, hypothetically and ideally, you're listening to what that person is doing. And you want what you're doing to match that person. So I think just automatically you find yourself trying to emulate what they're doing and accompanying them or kind of, you know what I'm trying to say, Julie? Help me.
I think so.
You're like, right.
Well, I'm visualizing it. I was actually wondering, like, who some of these people might have been, if you want to talk about names or anything.
All right, I'm going to start naming people.
Exactly.
Of course, Andrew and Noah, playing with you, playing with Max, and actually Debbie Knight is also a big person. If you guys don't know who Debbie Knight is, she's a New England piano player who doesn't get out of Boston much, but she has this amazing Cape Breton, New England just bounciness that I absolutely love playing with. Oh gosh, there's so many people. Another like lucky thing, as I have to say, is sorry, California, but New England has such a, you know, condensed amount of incredible folk musicians. And the Monday Night Concord Dance was a really cool thing. I mean, it still is, obviously. But the way that the Monday Night Concord Dance work is that Jack O'Connor, who runs it, invites two other musicians to play with him. And you might have never played with that musician. Right. And so you kind of show up and you're like, well, we'll see what happens. And so I got to play with people that I would never have gotten the chance to play with. Like I first played with Owen Morrison at that dance. Glenn Loper. I don't know, just Donald Sheets. I remember having a really fun time. Eric Eidreiner. It's just so cool that you just kind of get like randomly placed with these people.
Yeah.
And you just end up having so much fun and you don't know what to expect because you haven't played with these people. And that's also like a really cool place to learn new tunes as well, because Jack is kind of the person who collects tunes from the people that come play with him. And if he likes a tune, he'll keep it. And then the next week, you know, when the other musicians show up, he's like, oh, do you know this tune? And I'll be like, no, let's play it. And then, you know, and that's how kind of I think a lot of tunes get spread that way. It's because a bunch of people coming in on that dance and learning them through Jack O'Connor.
Yeah, all of a sudden we all know Turtle in the Grass.
I know.
Ari Friedman tune that Jack really loves, or, Scottish tunes or whatever Jack is interested in the time. It's fun. Mm-hmm. He was really into Wing Commander Donald McKenzie for a while, and so we all played that tune.
I'm embarrassed to say that I learned Winchell's Falls and Weed Walker from Jack.
That's because these are Noah tunes, which is why it's funny. But you didn't learn them from Noah. You learned them from Jack.
Nope. And I was in Wake Up Robin when I learned those tunes.
That's hilarious.
Oops.
Well, Jack stays pretty hip.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a great example of like how the Boston scene evolves and changes like any scene. You know, that was the Yankee Ingenuity dance for many, many years. And then the Yankee Ingenuity decided to retire. And then Jack and Don Vino continued that dance and re-envisioned it as a place that was, it's not quite sit-in friendly, but it's like one level apart from that where it's invitation friendly. But you could also sit in, you know, at times. And I played a lot of dances there, and I also met a lot of folks. Catherine Miller, I think I got to play with there for the first time, and Getting to play with Jack was really fun. Having seen him on stage for so many years from the different angle.
I actually remember being like, I got to play with Bruce Rosen at that Monday dance. And I remember being so nervous the first time I played with Bruce because that record, Phantom Power, was such a big deal for me when I was in high school. And when you're in Hawaii, you don't know any of these people. And so... And so I just like idolize him and his playing. And so getting a chance to play with him at the Monday night dance was extra special for me.
Yeah. I remember one Monday, Mark Simos came.
Wow.
And I played with him and I was equally terrified playing with Mark. You know, he's a Berklee professor and a songwriter and also enjoys dance, but does many other things. And that was really fun. And, you know, the MIT dance sadly doesn't really exist anymore. And it's nice that the Monday dance can pick up some of that, like being a playground for musicians to get to learn and meet each other and share repertoire. And there is a Boston repertoire. Another thing we should mention if we're talking about Boston is, of course, Roaring Jelly, which you started to talk about Debbie Knight. Debbie Knight has led Roaring Jelly, this like wonderful, would you call it a mega band?
I guess so, but an organized mega band.
Yeah. Yeah, and they have rehearsals and repertoire and a lot of tunes from Quebec and New England, and you can hear them at NEFA every year.
Yeah, and Debbie does a really good job of finding, you know, and she'll go out and find some tunes as well and goes in and teaches the tunes by ear. And then, yeah, and so I think that's another way that tunes get spread. Does the Bida open band still, I mean, it doesn't happen now, but that's another thing that I think about where musicians can meet each other at the Bida open band. And I remember having tons of fun when I was in Boston playing at those things. And I would host like the pre-parties at my house and really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and you were a Bida board member for a while.
Yeah, I kind of miss it.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we started Bida, I was wanting places to play selfishly. But as a piano player, it's really hard to sit in with people. And so I just... And I was really inspired by David Kaner's dances at the Greenfield Grange and the culture on the stage of just people sitting backstage and playing along or just watching, being very communal. And in Boston at the time, there wasn't totally a place. You could go to MIT and sit in with like a bunch of people and have really fun. And you could go to the Scout House and hear really great concert music. But there wasn't anything in between at the time for players at that level.
Yeah, actually, that reminds me is that... Before, I mean, I think I had maybe heard of Bida, like, but I got, you are the one that contacted me about the musician mentorship program, and Larry and Eden were playing the Bida dance, and you asked if I could, like, sit in with them, and so I got to play a contra dance with Eden and Larry, and that was so surreal. I remember being on stage. I'm like, is this really happening right now?
Yeah. This is Eden McAdam Summer and Larry Unger, a lot of the band Notorious. And yeah, that's what we wanted to try to do is create these opportunities where we could play. Like, I wanted to learn from these musicians with all this experience and get a chance to play with them. So we did that for a while.
Yeah. And again, for someone, you may not believe this, but, you know, I'm like maybe an introvert. Like I have introverted moments in my life and I would never have like actively like gone to the Bida dance and been like, hey, can I sit in or like try to like see how I can like get involved without knowing anybody. So again, it's just these like slight, you know, shoves from people inviting me to participate that I think is like really what allowed me to feel comfortable and kind of then finagle my way into the contra dance world.
Yeah. Well, we were all part of a scene. Like we were all peers together, you know, maybe a few years apart, but who cares, you know, but like there are just so many of us who were all learning to play for dances and there were different houses of people where all the dance musicians lived together.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, there's a house with Jonah Sidman and John Cannon and Neil Perlman and like
Michael Friedman.
Michael Friedman and, you know, like all these great people. And then there were other houses like I had a contra house and, you know, they were just and we would go. And I think Becca Bosworth Clemens lived there at some point, didn't she? I'm starting to blur memories. Now.
No, Amy lived with Jonah. Yeah. Amy was part of a contra dance household as well.
That was the house after Jonah's other house.
Oh my gosh. There's like
all these little offshoots.
That's pre-Audrey.
But like, you know, and I remember Jeff used to do these guerrilla contras in Davis Square. And we just yell the calls and all of us would get together and play our instruments outside and just feeling like we had our own neighborhood dance.
Oh my gosh. I remember. So the guerrilla contra dance, it was a pop-up dance in the middle of Davis Square. And I remember, I don't know if it was the first time I played with Jonah and John Cannon, but it was like the first time there was just like this magical experience. We were all huddled in playing and we, and I think someone called La Bastring, which is a kind of a, it's a circle dance. And we were playing and I think someone yelled out, someone's got to play the melody. Oops.
Sounds about right.
Gosh, yeah. I am forever grateful for that time in Boston and just being in the right time or right place at the right time and meeting so many incredible people and given, you know, opportunities that otherwise wouldn't have happened.
Oh. Yeah, we learned a lot informally, you know. I remember the first time I ever played at the Scout House. I'm pretty sure it was with Nor'easter. And I was just in awe of this place and the stage. And I went up, I'm sure, I interviewed Kate Barnes a few weeks ago, and I'm sure she would think the story is totally ridiculous. But I went up to the piano bench, and, you know, the piano's been there for a long time, and it's well-maintained, but it just has this legendary quality to it. You know, like back in the Yankee and Ingenuity days, they had the rearview mirror clipped to the side of the piano.
I think it's still there,
Yeah, it's still in the closet. Yeah. Not everyone uses it anymore. And I just remember going up to there's a cushion on the piano bench that someone had made, and it had gotten years of use. And it had a little, like, groove in the middle.
Oh, butt print!
Yeah, and I just remember thinking, whose butts have been on this? And just, like, in awe of this cushion on this piano bench. Just like, I'm putting my behind on this hallowed butt cushion.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh, I remember being so petrified playing that dance. And I think... like, I think the Free Raisins, the first time I played, like, it was the Friday advance dance, like, before we played the Thursday night dance. So I remember being, like, even more, like, nervous about it. Because I was like, does this mean that, like, we made it as a band? That we played the Friday night advance dance? Like, right. It's like these check marks, you know, as a contra dance musician is, like, playing, you know, at the Scout House, playing at NEFA, playing at the Flurry. You know, there's just these things that, yeah, that you feel pretty good after you do it. And you feel really good when you're doing it, too.
Playing the Dawn Dance.
Oh, my gosh.
Shift at the Dawn Dance.
That is something that you do once.
If you're smart.
It was an incredible experience that I never have to repeat ever again.
It wrecked me for like 2 days afterwards, but it was so worth it.
Oh, absolutely.
To this day, the first time we played, especially, one of my 10 most memorable dance experiences ever.
Yeah, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. We had Luke calling with us, Luke Donforth. And, you know, it's that whole thing. I mean, this happens every time, but when they turn the lights, you know, when they turn the lights off because the sun is rising, and you're like, I have literally been playing all night.
The whole hall erupts in cheers and people have this real sense of like, we made it.
I'm not sure what we did, but we did it.
And we sure smell good.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely.
What are some of your other favorite dance memories?
Oh, I was afraid you'd ask me this question.
I know, it's hard to ask such specific questions without being prepared.
I know. I don't know. You know, every weekend is special in its own way. Ah, I mean, it's true. But when I think about it, just recently, I guess last year, goodness, Amy and I played Camp Sturtevant. Have you ever heard of that camp before?
Is that the one where you have to hike into it?
Yes. Yes. So Camp Sturtevant unfortunately, the building may or may not still be there.
Because of the fires.
Because of the fires. It's unclear as of right now. It's just up Mount Wilson in Pasadena. And you show up. Put your stuff on donkeys, and the donkeys haul everything up, and you hike 4 miles up to this cabin, there's 30 people maximum, and it's just this one room where you eat and you dance and you hang out all in this one thing. But I had gotten there late because I was at a gig and I couldn't make it in time to put my stuff in the donkey. So I was carrying my backpack and then my fiddle on my chest, and then Amy and Derek brought their son Baxter, and so they're hiking 4 miles up with Baxter on their back and Dana Parkinson just there to cheer us on. But halfway up the hike, Dana was like, "You guys, I think this is a bad time to tell you that I'm afraid of heights." But we hiked up there and I was pretty nervous. It was just Amy and I playing, the two of us. I was like, how are we going to play an entire dance weekend with 30 people? How is this a dance weekend? And it was just this perfect combination of community and fun tunes. Amy had this brilliant idea of printing out the table of contents of the Portland books and then cutting up the names of the tunes into pieces of paper and putting it in a hat. And so we would go around, and the dances were short, so we only needed one tune sets. And so we would go around and asking people to take tunes out of the hat. And then we would play the tune out of the hat for better or for worse.
Yeah, how did those matches go?
You know, Dana was very kind as the caller and supportive of our decisions. And sometimes we would throw the tune away if it just didn't make any sense, or we would save it for later. We would write down each tune that we played, and then we would number it 1 through 3, whether or not we liked it or not.
Wow. You have data.
We have data on this. Exactly. And that was just the camaraderie and everyone having hiked, and then the next day you hike another 4 miles up to Mount Wilson. And so there's a lot of hiking involved, but it was gorgeous. And just because we're all here, 30 people, you're kind of forced to get to know people and people that you otherwise wouldn't have known otherwise. Right. It's so easy at a dance weekend to just stay with the people that you're excited to see and your friends, of course, and you want to do that. But in that kind of situation, it was really nice to kind of get myself out of my comfort zone and meet new people and really get to know other people that I otherwise wouldn't. And so that was definitely an experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they say that, you know, at its best, any tune goes with any dance. You know, I think with modern choreography and the diversity of tunes we have now, I don't think that's totally true anymore.
No. And part of the creative aspect of playing for contradance is that you have that liberty to, the caller hands you the card and it's your artistic job to find what you think will be best match the dance. And so that's I don't care, whatever, we'll play whatever. That's, you know, there are appropriate situations for that, like Camp Sturtevant, for example. But there's a beauty in that process that I think us conscientious musicians take pride in. I was very lucky to sub for Elixir a couple of times, and it was really interesting to see Anna Patton's process of picking tunes, and that this is very deliberate, and she'll sit down with the caller before the dance happens and pick everything out. And it's very deliberate, and the work pays off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd be curious to talk to you about your approach as a fiddler of matching tunes to dances. Ha ha! Now that you brought it up, you're stuck here. Gosh, you want to just talk about shoes again? Would you rather we do that?
No, I'm happy to talk about it. I mean, there's so many things that go into that process, into picking tunes. And I'm sure like maybe a bunch of people have already talked about this on your podcast. But it doesn't just depend on the dance at that time, but it also depends on what you just played, where that dance is in the particular evening, and genres. Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it.
Do you look at the card when you match, or do you have the caller tell you, or what's your personal process?
I personally prefer looking at the card. It's funny, because I play in a bunch of bands, every band is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. In the process, most of the time it's a group decision, and that we are all pretty much on the same page when that comes to it. So for dance weekends, it's always nice to know, especially if it's the evening dance, kind of get an idea of what the caller is going to be doing. So again, meeting with them in advance, even if they don't know the very specific dances, they can give us an idea of what they're looking for. And so always looking at the card before the dance starts, knowing where the balances are. And of course, as a dance band, we have the sets that we want to play, right? We know that what sets work and that we want to feature. And so we kind of make sure that those can work into whatever the evening or the dance program, make sure we can get those in and like not play our ending set first thing at the beginning, right? like you may want to save it towards the end.
Yeah.
What I do like about playing with Wake Up Robin is that we do have a certain amount of sets that we have kind of arrangement wise, but there's also especially kind of in the morning sessions where it's a little bit more laid back and the caller is doing a specific session or whatever, this mm-hmm. is kind of the time that we like to play around as a band, because we don't live near each other. In fact, we all live in like the four opposite corners of the United States right now.
Yeah.
And so there's no possible way that we can rehearse. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating. If we really wanted to, I guess we could. But
just to fill people in, that's with Amy in Seattle, you in California, mm-hmm. Andrew in Syracuse, New York, and Noah in Asheville, North Carolina.
Right, exactly. So, like, we're not close.
Yeah.
And we were lucky enough that we played enough dance weekends together that we weren't, like, rusty or anything when we got together. But we would take the morning sessions as an opportunity to perhaps expand our repertoire. And so I would pick a tune that I preferably knew, or a tune that I was excited about, and we would start off with that. And so we start off with a tune and kind of a mood, and Amy and Andrew would kind of lay down the groove, and they kind of would communicate musically about kind of where that groove was going. And then Noah would kind of listen for a while or play along if he knew the melody or not. But then kind of figure out maybe a rhythmic lick or a melodic phrase that would match the tune in the specific groove. And so we have these like different layers that would happen. So by the time, and usually this is just with one tune, that we have these multiple layers. We have four people, three of them have the opportunity to play rhythm. I guess I could play rhythm too, but we have all these different playing blocks. And mm-hmm. so you can have just rhythm or just melody and that one rhythmic lick that, you know, Noah or Andrew or whoever came up with. And so you have these like three, four different things that you can play around with, and either by verbalizing it or kind of making a big head nod, or you feel everyone kind of building up and someone yells something. It's just like really fun, organic experience of making up arrangements on the fly. And because we have we have four people in the group, it's a little bit easier to do it that way. And then having so many flexible musicians who can play both melody or rhythmic stuff, that there's just so many different combinations. And so that was like kind of like what I really looked forward to in dance weekends, actually, was that creative aspect and kind of experimenting on the fly.
Mm-hmm. And weekends are great to do that, or tours. Mm-hmm. You know, like having, they test you in different ways. Like as when we talk about being a new band, tours give you the chance to try a set multiple times on multiple days and improve it. And weekends stretch your repertoire to exactly. the end, and they really force you. I remember one of Nor'easter's first dance weekends, it was a smaller weekend, you know, and they want to take a chance on a new band, which mm-hmm. we greatly appreciated. And yeah. we were the only band, and we played for 18 hours of dancing in 3 days.
I'm having flashbacks of very similar yeah. dance weekends.
That's a lot of tunes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we were really pulling out things that we hadn't played before, or, you know, but it was fun to do. It's a wonderful thing. Or like playing it for CDH, playing it Contra Dancers Delight Holiday. The first time Noah and I played for that, that's a week. And everyone's all together in the same hotel place for a week. And there's hours of dancing every day, hours and hours and hours every day. Yeah. And there's multiple bands, but each band is playing between 2 and 6 hours a day, something like that. And a whole week of that, like, you will go through your set list.
You are forced to be creative.
Yeah. And so those afternoon sessions, like you're talking about, those little breakout sessions, I'd be like, Noah, just make up a tune. You'd be like, exactly. Okay.
Right.
And so he'd do potatoes. He'd just start playing a tune and I'd listen to it. I'd give him a few times to like figure out what it might be until it starts mm-hmm. to crystallize into a form. Yeah. And then eventually I'd come in on it and he'd yell chords to me if I didn't get them. Sometimes I got them. Sometimes yeah. I didn't, you know, and like, or, hey, Noah, I'm going to play a tune that you don't know on the mm-hmm. piano. And that's fun to do things like that. And we made up a lot of stuff.
Yeah. For the record, I would not recommend doing this if you haven't played with your bandmates for a long time. That right. this is something that, you know, that is extremely enjoyable because we have played for so long together that we know each other's playing. I'm not saying they're predictable, but like we're so used to and accustomed to their playing that it's not this intimidating thing or like we, yeah. And so generally it doesn't crash and burn.
It's true. Like, it's easy to forget that when you yeah. play with someone enough, you learn their instincts and you learn their vocabulary tools and you knew how to listen and lock in with each other. And
yeah.
all this. And you learned, like, what the glance with the eyebrows up means versus the glance where you just shake your head or, you know, like, all those different things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, like, now with, like, technology, like, if we're, like, this groove is, like, really awesome, I'll just turn on my phone and hit the record button so that we can remember what we did.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's kind of how we come up with new sets.
I mean, sometimes that's all the time we have.
Yeah.
And sometimes absolutely. Those are the most inspired things. Like, even if we try to have a rehearsal, rehearsal's a different setting. You don't get the same input from the dancers and just that raw, that thing that forces you to do it on the fly because you have to be in the moment when yeah. you're playing for dancers.
Yeah. And you know immediately whether or not it's working or not. If they're throwing things at you from the floor, you know it's not working.
The dance grinds to a halt.
The caller gives you, like, the look of the devil. Like, maybe you should do something different.
So, Audrey, I'm going to ask you a question that I wouldn't normally ask you as, like, Julie the person. But as an interviewer, I'll ask you the slightly stilted question.
Go for it.
But like, what do you think of as your job as a contra dance fiddler? Right?
Wow. What is my job?
Like, what's going through your head besides yeah. looking for fun people on the dance floor? What else is going through your head?
Like, immature Audrey is like, well, to have fun, duh.
Well, I mean, that is kind of the point. Like, let's not take this too seriously, right? It's literally the point.
Yeah.
There is no other point.
That's a really good point. Luckily, like, my musical aesthetic happens to match what is required in a contra dance.
How convenient.
Yeah. I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. Gosh. I mean, the most, like, obvious answer is, like, make sure they're having fun and dancing, blah, 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 and that they're having a good time. But for me, this sounds so hokey, but being myself is like really important to me, or not having to pretend that I'm somebody else that I'm not. And I feel grateful that the contra dance has accepted me for who I am, both musically and as a person. And I think being genuine in playing and as a community member is crucial. And I think people notice that. And so having fun and enjoying myself is part of that. And mm-hmm. if I'm having fun playing music, I think that that comes across in the dancing, hopefully, ideally.
Absolutely.
It's just, you have to be careful, like, because part of me enjoying it and having fun is how I feel like I can be creative and share what I have with people. And that is important. So I think if I'm not having fun or not enjoying myself, I don't know if dancers can tell, but it's important for me, at least. Like, it's not worth it for me if I'm not enjoying it. And of course, not, you know, every dance is not going to be like the highlight of my life and every dance is going to be perfect. And like, we know that. And sometimes you have off days, like that's the reality of life, right? Like, I'm not going to deny that. But on average, right? That knowing that I am enjoying myself and that what I am doing is positive and having a positive impact on people, I think is my job. I hate that word.
Ugh. Right?
I mean, it's so complicated.
I should have said role. But still, I think that's a great answer. I think you put a lot of your heart into your playing.
I have no choice. I mean, it's just like, I can't do anything else.
Right. Well, that's also who you are as a person, you know, but your playing has this wonderful energy to it. And there's times when, like, especially if you're playing and there's like lots of other things going on, like Noah and I were talking about this in Wake Up Robin, where you probably get that a lot, where like I was like asking, what does Audrey do when like Noah and Andrew and Amy are all locked in this really loud riff or something? And I was saying that you always find a way just to soar above everything. Like, you come up with these fiddle lines that just soar, and you have this really amazing tone, which is something you kind of in a way have in common with Lissa. You know, you have different kinds of backgrounds, but mm-hmm. you both have this really beautiful tone, this clear tone that just sails above everything else. And so when you like let it fly, and it's really great.
I have to say, there is nothing in this world like having three rhythmically in sync people to play along with. It is like, it's like this truck that's just going full force, and I get to like stand on top of the truck going, woo!
You're the person waving from the parade float or something.
Yeah, it is so, it is so amazing.
And you also do that with Free Raisins, of course, you know, but like, a good rhythm section is really an amazing thing. It liberates you to do so many things.
Yeah, it liberates me to not play if I don't want to.
Also true. It sounds like when you play, you're not thinking about the technical aspects of playing. Like, you're not consciously, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're not consciously thinking about, is the tempo right or not? Or how is my phrasing? Or is this matching the moves of the dance? But that you intuitively know it and you've learned it from playing dances. So you don't have to think about it or articulate it, but you still do it.
I mean, if I play a really awful note, like, I will be very aware of that awful note. Whoops, before just changed keys by accident there. Whoops. you're absolutely right. And I think you don't have time as a contra dance musician. If you're thinking about, you know, did I breathe in the right place? Did I have that, you know, did that note land the exact way that I wanted? There's not time for that. And that you hope that by the mood that you're trying to convey, that you're doing all of those things subconsciously. And then again, by playing so much that you have built these skills without having to be intentional about it. And that you can let the creativity and your mood reflect what you're playing. And I have to say, playing a lot for, I know this is a contra dance podcast, but playing for English dancing, that I have done a fair amount of, especially this past couple of years, has also really affected the way that I perceive music, and I think has heightened my listening skills as well. Because in English, you are, you know, you're given the tune, so you don't have that creative aspect of, you know, because ideally the tune already matches the dance. And that it's even more crucial as an English musician to be listening to your to the musicians around you. And there's a little bit more space in English as well to be more intentional about tone and spacing and breathing, because not every tune is 120 BPM, right? And you have a little bit more space. And so I actually am really grateful for playing English, because I do have a little bit more time being like, this is in the key of F. I'm going to be really intentional about landing that second finger just the way I want it to. Or about like the speed of the vibrato or what angle my bow is going to be in. And that it's kind of a fun challenge in English to do that. And hopefully, because I have the time in English to think about that aspect more, that in theory, it crosses over in the contra dance world. I'm making a lot of hand gestures, folks. You can't see that. And I'm not usually a hand gesture person, but
I'm enjoying
feels appropriate
it
right now. I don't know. But
they're fiddle bowing kinds of gestures.
Exactly. So hopefully I think playing a lot of English has helped me a little bit in playing for contra dances, and kind of helped keep that technique and tone and phrasing in mind. Faces.
I'm wondering, like, it's funny to ask you a question about your repertoire as a fiddler, because your repertoire probably depends a lot on who you're playing with and what setting you're in.
I was gonna say also who I'm dating at the time.
Right? Like, are you dating an Irish tenor banjo player?
Sorry, folks. No, I mean, it's totally true. I'm either cursed or blessed with the fact that I love all so many different genres of music. And I think that's why contra dance music appeals to me so much, is that I am attracted to all of these things. I can't just pick one. My dad is I have to blame my dad also for kind of my initial love of music. And we would have every Sunday evening, we would have music night as a family when we were young, and it would always either feature a genre or an artist, a composer, and we'd spend that evening kind of learning the history and doing just some deep listening. But one of his favorite genres is old time. My dad plays mostly old time these days. And so I kind of got that bug as a teenager of kind of playing old time. And but also kind of getting sucked into the Irish world as an Irish dancer. And I am currently dating a wonderful human who plays the Irish pipes and whistles and flutes. And it's been so much fun to kind of dig in a little deeper with that, mm-hmm. Being here in San Diego, and like playing with a piper is unlike anything else. They are a complete orchestra with mm-hmm. the drones and the regulators and the melody, and really listening in and kind of doing some deep listening of pipes, which I have never done before. And I've kind of noticed my playing shifting a little bit, and listening to the way he plays and the way that he ornamentation and how he plays tunes that I've played forever, but hearing how these very specific piping things go on, and really fun to kind of emulate that a little bit. So I think, yeah, it's been situational, but I'm playing a lot more Irish these days and absolutely having a blast doing it.
Do you find that Irish tunes work well for contra dancing?
Ooh, trick question.
Oh, I know. That was so loaded. Set you up to fail.
I was should have had that coming. So not just with Irish music, but with like any trad music, there has to be a little bit of flexibility with it when you're playing for contra dances, specifically because of tempos, and the way that the tune's phrasing matches the dance. And actually, I would make this argument with both old time and Irish, that if you play it 100% strictly or the way that you would play it in a session, it's not necessarily fun for the dancers. And so there has to be a little bit of flexibility in your playing in order to work with the dancing. So like an old time, picking a 32 bar tune doesn't hurt, right? Mm-hmm. But picking a well-phrased 32 bar tune also doesn't hurt. And maybe changing keys every dance, maybe, I don't know. And with Irish music, if you were to try to play an Irish tune the way that you would at session at 120 BPM all night with all the little doohickeys and whatnot, no one's going to notice it, and you are going to, it's going to be too jumbled. Wow. This mm-hmm. is a strong opinion. Who, these are Audrey's thoughts, and these are, they're willing to change, but this is how I currently feel in the moment, that you just have to be a little bit careful when you are, playing, strictly trad tunes without thinking about the dancers in mind. Whew. I hope I didn't offend anyone with that. Them. Yes, but you have to contrify them with paying respect to the genre as well.
Right, or else they're not satisfying. Like
Someone
I know who, we were all really into the tune The Road to Malvern for a while. Really great old-time tune. Really crooked.
I was like, that is crooked, my dear.
Yeah, the B part is too short. It's missing a whole phrase at the end. And I had a friend who will not be named, Peter Buchek, who really wanted to play it for dances. And so we like made up a new phrase to put at the end of the B part so we could play for dances. And it was like kind of fun, but that it takes away the magic of the tune, you know? Yeah. Like
the magic of the tune is that it's crooked. Yeah.
Yeah, like the phrases are already just the right length for it to say what it needs to say. It was complete as it was.
Yeah. And like Red Prairie Dawn is close enough to Road to Malvern that you can like play Red Prairie Dawn for contra dances instead. Like there's so many other tunes that I would feel weird about kind of. Yeah. Oh, this is like controversy territory.
I know.
Right now.
Well, ooh. There is one common tune in the contra repertoire, Fleur de Mandragore, which actually is crooked in the original version. There's an extra beat right at the beginning of the B part.
Yeah.
And everybody takes it out. And I love that extra beat. So I kind of stopped playing it for concha dances.
Yeah.
It's okay. We can be controversial because I'm a curmudgeon. So yeah. It's all right, Audrey.
So for the record, the Free Raisins also play it crooked, but we will make sure the dance, it's crooked at the end of the A2 going into the B1. And if there is a dance move at the top of the B1 that doesn't have a balance, or it's a very smooth, like it's a hey or something, we might throw it in at the end of the tune, not the entire time through. I don't know. I still go back and forth about it, honestly. It's a tricky one. And maybe I have to be in the right mood for it. But I don't know. I'm making faces. You can't see my faces right now, but
she's making uncomfortable faces. I mean, you can play slightly crooked tunes for concha dances as long as you line the crooked part up with the dance. I haven't seen this, but someone told me that David Keener would do things like that when he was calling, because he's also calling and fiddling and picking the tunes. He could kind of line up the parts. Someone can write to me and tell me if that's a true story or not, but it would not surprise me in the least.
I just don't want the dancers to be like uncomfortable, you know, like if there's something like weird in the tune and you're not a musician, but you feel, or you're like, something's not quite right. You know, like when the tune doesn't quite line up with the dance, like there's just this slight uneasiness, or you have to, a little bit more brain power has to happen when that's happening. And you don't want, I'm like, you don't want the dancers to think like, but you don't want them to like that take away from what's happening, I guess is the most important thing.
Pulls them out of their dance experience.
Exactly.
Even things like waltzes. We were playing a waltz from Quebec, L'Ange au Patin. Mm-hmm. A beautiful waltz. Yeah. And it's straight in terms of it has all measures of three, but it has an odd number of measures at the end of the B part.
Where you end up on your left foot instead of your right foot
exactly. at the top. Exactly. And so we didn't know any better. And we're like, let's play this. It's so beautiful. And I thought, well, it's all in three. What does it matter? But some of the dancers came up and... was a long time ago, and said, we ended up on the wrong foot. Was that us? Are we crazy? And then I'm like, well, after one more time through the waltz, you'll be back on the right foot again.
True confessions of Julie and Audrey.
Yeah, right? I know. This is funny. This is like we reminisce about cheese, Boston, and our dance mistakes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and also like trial and error. But as a general rule, like, I would not want to play crooked tunes for a dance or try to like make it fit the dance by changing the tune. There are just too many tunes in the world, and there are other opportunities to play, you know, those crooked tunes.
Yeah, absolutely. They have a home somewhere else.
We just not in concha dance.
Good New England concha dance tunes. Like, let's play the ones that are really good for the dance. I mean, I find that some Irish tunes have phrasing that is good for conchas, and then some of them have kind of windy, squirrely, long phrases that aren't good. Or I would only use them for some dances that have like long moves, like a full hey or something like that.
Right, exactly.
You know? So you have to keep all those things in mind.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you live in California now, where you've been for a while, and we've been just talking about Boston because that's what we have in common. We haven't talked about the California dance scene at all. And by the way, I just want to note to everyone who listens to this podcast, I do think it's important for us to talk about other regions of the country besides New England. And I promise you we will. It's just with coronavirus, it's been easiest to do it on my porch with people who live near me. But
I'll be the cross between the two.
You can be our gate. Way, but I do want to talk to people from all over the country, and don't worry, you are on my list of people to talk to. But would you like to talk at all about the West Coast scene and your experiences there?
I would love to. I first moved to the Bay Area going on 2 or 3 years ago, goodness gracious. Community or being part of the local dance is kind of important for me, even though I've been traveling a lot. It just makes me feel grounded, I guess. Mm-hmm. And having been part of BIDA, I just felt natural to be involved. And so I immediately like showed up. I was like, hey, everybody, I'm here. And the Bay Area has such an awesome dance scene, both concha dance and English dance, and helped for a time with the Wednesday night dance with Eric Hoffman, and just a really great group of folks, and felt really honored to be a part of it. and played as much as I possibly could. And luckily, most of the dances happened during the weekdays, so I could travel during the weekends and come back and play the local dances through there. And I mean, there's dances, so many dances there. And I felt at home there, come from Boston and coming, you know, to the Bay Area, to a pretty healthy dance community was very nice. And playing a bunch of dances with Chris Knepper and Christopher Jacoby, especially Christopher, and you know, Christopher. But we went back way back from the East Coast, and having him as a musician buddy in Oakland was like important, very important to me. Mm-hmm. So, and got an opportunity to play with, yeah, again, Chris Knepper, Daniel Steinberg is out there as well. Mm-hmm. And Eric Hoffman, and just great folks. And then I played just as much English as I did contra dance over there, and just anyways, I should just go on how lovely everybody is, but just trust me that I felt very much at home there. And good old Claire Takamori as well. It was really nice to kind of form a friendship with her. And so when kind of the world came crashing to a halt earlier this year, kind of took this opportunity to spend some time in San Diego, where my partner lives, and kind of making this my, I guess, like a formal announcement to the world, but this is kind of my permanent home right now. And I don't know what that means for the local contra dance. I'm very lucky that Franny and her husband Bill live over here, and we've had some social distance hang times with her.
Aww.
And feel really grateful that she's around here. But I'm curious about what that's going to mean when things open up again, and looking forward to potentially getting to know the San Diego community as well. And LA is like also like the local community, even though LA is like 2 hours away without traffic, so it's like actually 6 hours away. So I'm actually really curious about what's going to happen the coming year for me music wise locally. I have to say the West Coast has like some of the most fun dance weekends, like because the West Coast, everything is so spread apart from each other that the local communities, you know, obviously exist, but I really think that the whole West Coast really comes together in the dance weekends. And so there's just some absolutely phenomenal dance weekends out here in California and the Pacific Northwest, and they do a really good job with those.
Yeah. Dance weekends in Seattle and Portland, Oregon, like Rain Dance, you know, and then all up and down the California coast. Like Franny is one of the organizers of Fiddling Frog.
Yeah. Yes.
And like, I know like a lot of my friends who I run into dance week, the bands who I run into at dance weekends, a lot of them are from the West Coast, like Jeff Spiro, who's piano player, also organizer down in LA. Just so many folks.
Yeah. The Syncopass, like Ashley is so much fun to play with. And we had a couple of gigs lined up, this year that obviously aren't happening, with me, her and Jeff. And I hope to do that when things settle down again.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I want to hear those.
Me too. Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. It's lovely folks.
I hope. Yeah. So California is not so bad.
I'm glad that you found a good home, even if it is far away from us.
Yeah.
I mean, we're adjusting to this, but like there was a time when it didn't matter if we were all in different states because we would see each other. Like there really was this kind of weird national meta community of people, like the dancers.
Yeah.
You see dancers at CDH in West Virginia. You see the same folks at a weekend in Florida. You see the same folks at a weekend in California. And so,
yeah, I feel like I saw you. I feel like I saw you more, you know, at dance weekends, even though we like lived in the same city. It's just like,
right.
that's where you see people. And I never worried about not seeing folks because I was like, I'll just see you at the next dance weekend. And like having friends all over the country was, like, I didn't think twice about it. And so now it's very different. And I have to say, I have a love-hate relationship with the internet right now, I think, as everybody does. The positive side is, you know, it's allowing me to stay in communication with folks and doing these online contra dances and whatnot. I do feel connected. It's not the same. I think everyone knows that. but we're doing our best, obviously. And like, you're creating these podcasts, and like, we're all trying to figure out ways of staying in the community right now. And I think it's awesome that you have figured out a way to stay involved. And I've been doing these conjure dancings. I've got plug my Monday night tunes class called Tunes and Stuff.
Yeah, Tunes and Stuff with Audrey. Oh, it is the place to be. So what kind of tunes have you been teaching in your Tunes and Stuff class?
Everything. We're on week number 23 right now. And what I like about this class is that it's kind of open-ended in that I pick a tune preferably that I know, or that I know. So far, I'm picking tunes that I know. I know. I take the first half of the class to teach it, and then kind of take the second half, the stiff part, to be whatever I want. So it can be talking about chords, melody, harmony, bowing, or like history lessons. Like, yeah, yes, we were talking about Breton stuff the other day and kind of being able to play examples. And it's a really fun kind of platform to do that. It's strange though. Like, I've never thought of myself as being kind of a teacher. Like, you teach at camps and kind of teach a tune, but it's a totally different thing. And now it's been kind of an interesting process. Again, like I was talking about earlier about like, oh, I actually have to think about my bowing for once in my life and really forcing myself to break down, why does this tune sound good? Why does it work for contra dances? And it's been kind of a fun learning experience for me. It's one I really, really enjoy doing, my Monday night class. It's been kind of very grounding for me of like, what does it mean to be a musician right now, a full-time musician? And I have to do stuff in order for me to function. I have to be busy. Mm-hmm. I have to be producing stuff. And it's honestly like a little overwhelming right now because, you know, as a musician right now, if you want to continue being a quote unquote musician, you have to be online. You have to be on the internet. You have to have this presence. And so there's like this weird pressure. I don't know if pressure is the right word, but it's like we have to figure out a way of continuing to be a part of the community or to make money or both, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's been kind of an interesting experience for me to figure that out. And what does it mean for me right now, living in San Diego and still wanting to feel connected with everyone? So this Monday night class has been grounding. Yeah, having something every week that I can look forward to and work on and continue to get better at teaching as well. And, you know, and doing various concerts and Zoom contra dances and whatnot, and doing sound has always been, it's been fun and also a learning experience.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
Yeah. Well, there's ways that we can continue to grow and enrich our community, even if we can't all be together. And one of the nice things about these online classes is that people who normally don't have, like, they might not live near a big contra dance center. And now musicians from all over the country can take these classes and get to learn and practice and have something to focus on.
Yeah, I have a woman that comes every week to my class who lives in Hobart, Tasmania, and runs a contra dance there. And I'm just like, that would never, ever happen, you know, otherwise.
Wait, there is a contra dance there in Tanzania? In Tanzania? Is that what you said?
Tasmania.
Tasmania. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. How did that start?
Well, it's funny. We just had like a hangout time after class yesterday about it, and kind of asked her the same question. And I think she has like some English friends or whatever that brought it over. But because it's an island and they've been kind of very isolated from the rest of the world, they're able to actually have dances again, slowly but surely, that they're able to start dancing. So it was really encouraging to hear that. That they've started to do it again. And there's an old time community there as well. Like, what? Like, of course.
Old time community of Tasmania.
Right. Yeah. Do they play with Tasmanian accents? That's what I want to know.
That's the great thing about these traditions, right? Is that they move around and they take on a thing of their own. Like, you know, we always talk about when we play English country dance tunes, they don't sound like the way they play them over there. Of course. Or when we play French tunes, they don't really sound like that either.
No, no matter how much French cheese we eat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was interesting, like when we were in London together and the London Barn Dance, like that's such a trippy experience that you're quote, you know, we're playing an American tradition and dancing an American tradition in England. And it is so much fun, but it's slightly different, not in a bad way at all. But it's slightly different.
It is. The dancers move differently.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's different, but it is fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate you doing these interviews. And again, we're like all, I was like, we're all in this together. Like we all have our different situations, but we're all trying to figure it out. And I feel so lucky to have the Contra Dance and just the folk community to, I feel very supported right now. Like things obviously aren't easy. Like I'm not going to pretend that like life is perfect. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't do it without the community and feeling supported. And yeah. And so, you know, who knows how long this is going to be and it's, you know, and if it's going to get easier or not. But I feel as good as one possibly can in this situation.
Yeah, I also feel very grateful for this community that we have here.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful to you for sharing your time with us. It's been so much fun to talk to you, Audrey.
My pleasure, Julie. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks for listening to Contra Pulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit contrapulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!